I'd like now to welcome to the program Chris Moore. He's a professor of computer science, physics, and astronomy at the University of New Mexico, and he's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you're giving a talk called Sending Secrets, Security and Cryptography in a Quantum World. So cryptography, that means basically putting things in code.
Yes, it means sending secret messages that you want the recipient to receive, but you don't want anyone listening in to be able to decode it.
Since the beginning of cryptography, I mean, what are the earliest instances that we know of cryptography? Who was encoding what and why?
Well, we know that Julius Caesar sent secret messages to his generals. We know that even the Kama Sutra recommended that women learn the art of secret writing to keep the details of their liaison secret. And we know that certainly nations involved in war and diplomacy have been sending each other and their agents in the field secret messages for as long as nations have been doing that sort of thing. Modern computer science got its start in the effort in World War II to decrypt the Nazi Enigma code, an effort of which Alan Turing was one of the heroes.
I find that amazing that modern computer science is grounded so deeply in decoding.
Right. I think that in order to break the Nazi codes, the British cryptographers really had to push the computing technology of the time. And because they had to do it quickly, they would literally intercept the messages in the morning and hopefully decrypt them sometime during the day. And so they had to build larger and faster computers. And this really led into the electronic computers that then, as we know, became smaller and faster and eventually became personal devices. So sadly, a lot of technological advances are driven by war, and computing was one of them.
Let's go back to Julius Caesar. What kind of codes do we know that he used, that they used in that time?
So Caesar was fond of shifting letters in the alphabet. So I think a lot of kids even know this trick of shifting each letter three places in the alphabet so that the word cat would become, so the C would become D-E-F, the A would become B-C-D, and right. So you'd send, F-D... what is it, W or something?
Right.
And then, of course, to decrypt it, you just shift it back. That kind of cryptosystem is pretty easy to break. And so
indeed. I guess even in that time, people probably figured out pretty quickly.
I expect so. And then there's also, in the puzzle section of the newspaper, you have these crypto quips, and you can often break those by looking at what the most common letters are and so on. But, of course, things got more and more sophisticated over the ages. Thomas Jefferson invented a cryptosystem which is pretty hard to break that involves different cylinders that do lots of different substitutions in the alphabet, and you can switch around the cylinders to do all sorts of different codes. And then the Nazi Enigma machine was quite clever in that every time you pressed another letter, another key on the encryption machine, the Enigma machine, it changed what code it would use for all the rest of the message. So the code was constantly changing in different ways, depending on what letters you pressed. And that's what made it so hard for the Allies to break. But then now we live in an age where you're sitting in this cafe, you want to buy something online, you're going to send your credit card number or a password over the network. Well, other people could be listening into that network. So if your computer is doing it right, it's encoding that message. And so we use now something called public key cryptography for much of commerce nowadays. I mean, all the online transactions you make. So it turns out that if you could build a quantum computer, many of the cryptosystems, in fact, most of the cryptosystems we use today to keep those transactions secure could be broken by that quantum computer. And this was discovered in 1994 by a very smart guy named Peter Shor. So the question is, well, if quantum computers are going to become a reality, and I think that there's a good chance that they will at some point, will we still have privacy? Will we still have encryption? Will there still be some kind of cryptosystem that even quantum computers can't break? So what I'm going to talk about tonight, I'm going to give a very gentle introduction to the history of cryptography. I'm going to give a gentle introduction to how modern cryptography works. I promise there'll be nothing beyond high school math, and not even that much high school math. And so hopefully, if you come to the talk, you'll get a pretty good sense of how these things work, and at least some sense of why quantum computers could break them.
What is a quantum computer?
So I think a lot of your listeners know that quantum physics has all sorts of weird things going on. Electrons can be in two places at once to some extent. You can have probabilities adding in phase or out of phase. You have all this quantum weirdness, right, that we don't see in the everyday world when tennis balls are here and not there. Cats are usually only dead and only dead or alive and not both, and so on. So, roughly speaking, the idea of a quantum computer is one that could try many different solutions to a problem at once, sort of the way that elementary particles can be in many different places at once, and arrange things so that the right answer adds up and the wrong answers all cancel out. And people are working very hard in laboratories all over the world to try to create these computers. And the technology is still at a very early stage, but it is evolving, and I think it will probably become a reality sometime this century.
Is the hardware fundamentally different from current computer hardware?
There are a lot of different technologies you could use to try to build a quantum computer. Some of them use superconductors. Some of them use the spins of the nuclei of atoms. But people are starting to build quantum computers on chips. And they're doing amazing things where they can build a chip that literally takes a single atom and moves it down a little track and moves it around a corner until it bumps into another single atom. They interact and carry out a step of the computation, and then it moves them back down here. So
that's mind-boggling.
Yes, sorry. It's amazing. I mean, you know, you may have seen these pictures where people have, you may have seen these photographs where people have drawn pictures with single atoms laid out on a little crystal. And so the things that people can do nowadays are quite amazing. It's still very tricky to build a quantum computer, though, because even a stray, a little particle of light or a tiny magnetic field from the outside world can come in and screw up the computation, sort of cause the quantum state to collapse, as we say. So building these is a challenge. But also, as someone who works in computer science and mathematics and physics, part of our motivation is to understand what the basic computational power of the world is.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so we live in a world with certain laws of physics and certain laws of chemistry that come out of those laws of physics, and all sorts of wonderful things can happen in this world. Life can happen in this world, and thinking and cognition and consciousness can happen in this world. So what kinds of computation do these laws of physics let us do? Are they just the computations that we know about today that we can do on an everyday laptop on our desks? Or are there other sorts of computations that physics makes possible that are actually very much beyond the abilities of the computers we have today? So quantum computing is a fascinating field because even if quantum computers never become a reality, we're learning more about what the computational power is of the universe that we live in.
So we're talking to Chris Moore, who is giving a talk tonight at the James A. Little Theater. It's part of the Santa Fe Institute lecture series. It's called Sending Secrets, Security and Cryptography in a Quantum World. So far, what is the nature of the most effective encryption?
So there's a type of encryption called RSA, and it's what we often use when we're doing online transactions or when banks are sending data to each other. And we don't know for sure that it can't be broken. But the reason we think it can't be broken is that it's very hard, as far as we know, to take a really large number and figure out how to break it into its factors. So what do I mean by that? Well, if I give you two numbers and I ask you to multiply them together, you know it might be tedious if they're both very large, but you know how to do it. You did it in grade school and you could get the answer. But if I give you that product and ask you to figure out what two numbers you multiplied together to get it.
What two prime numbers?
What two prime numbers? We think that going backwards that way, reversing the process of multiplication, is much harder. But the interesting thing is that we know how quantum computers could do it efficiently, even though we don't know how today's computers could do it efficiently.
Aren't there lists of prime numbers going up into very high numbers?
That's certainly true, but we're talking about using numbers 1,000 digits long, so much higher than any of those lists go. And we think that it would take a standard computer, even today's fastest computer, even the fastest computer that you'll have in 10 years, which will be faster than the ones we have now, but we think that to factor a 1,000 or 2,000 digit number would really take an astronomical amount of time. There are just too many possibilities to search through. But there's a clever way, which I'll explain tonight, that quantum computers could do this. And that, to be honest, is one of the main reasons why lots of people are trying very hard to build quantum computers. It's not the only one.
Why? They want my credit card number?
They want your credit card number. they want to... I think, since nations started doing cryptography, everyone wants to be better at it than everybody else. Everyone wants to have codes that the others can't break, and everyone wants to be able to break everybody else's codes. And so that's why part of the purpose of my research and my colleagues' research is to find codes that will remain secure even if and when quantum computers are built.
How's that going so far?
Well, we have a candidate. It's actually a 30-year-old cryptosystem called the Michaelis cryptosystem. And we think what we've been able to prove so far is that the same techniques that break RSA cryptography, the kind that we use today, we've proved that these same techniques cannot break the Michaelis cryptosystem. So we think it's a good candidate for something we could use. And so that even if somebody recorded all your messages and built a quantum computer 50 years from now, they still wouldn't be able to go back and translate your messages. So now it's very hard to prove that you cannot solve a problem, right? There are so many different approaches you could take. We use the word algorithm to describe a method or an approach to a problem. What we've done is rule out the largest class of algorithms that people know about. But there are probably many more that no one has thought of. So we don't know for sure that this code can't be cracked. But then again, we don't know for sure that the codes you're using to do online transactions right now can't be cracked either.
Although there's a pretty good record now.
Yes, but maybe people just haven't been clever enough to figure out the right algorithm yet. Maybe factoring isn't as hard as we think it is. It's hard to prove these things.
And surely there's a whole bunch of people working on it.
I'm sure there are, yes. And some people I know about and some people I don't know about.
Right, right. We're talking to Chris Moore. So let's talk more. I'm so over my head on this. I don't even know what to ask you, but about quantum technologies, quantum computers. I mean, you've given us kind of a sense which most of us don't understand, and indeed probably all of you are on the edge of understanding of this. But
right.
Lay it on us.
Well, there are a lot of different ways that people were trying to build a quantum computer. My friend Ivan Deutsch at the physics department at UNM has been working on something called optical lattices. So what this is you form a kind of field with a couple of lasers crossing each other. And then where these lasers cross, there are places where you can put atoms, and they'll just sit there, floating in space. So it's a kind of crystal. But it's not held together by the usual forces between atoms.
Atoms of what?
I'm not even quite sure.
Atoms of what?
Anyway, I guess the problem with this computer is that if you had a power outage and the lasers went off, your entire computer would disappear in a puff of smoke. But while they're there, held in place by the lasers, you can do all kinds of exotic things to them. You can make these atoms move closer to each other or farther away. You can control how much they interact. And the idea is that you could actually have enough control over the atoms and where they are to cause them to act like a computer, to do steps of a computation this way. Another technology is called an ion trap. So here you take an atom. If it's missing some of its electrons, then it's charged. And then you can trap it in a little chamber where it's pushed away from all the walls of the chamber. So again, it's floating in space. And the idea is that in this chamber, you could set up vibrations and fields that would, again, cause these atoms trapped there to do a computation, to do something like break a cryptosystem or factor a number. And one of the wonderful things about this is you can see pictures where you see a dot, another dot, another dot, another dot, and those are atoms. Those are single atoms. So
pictures.
Yes, you can see photographs of single atoms now.
How do you photograph something that small?
That's an excellent question. I don't actually know. But it's fantastic that we can engineer things with single atoms. It's like, so maybe some of your listeners are going to St. John's or went to St. John's a while ago. Wouldn't it be wonderful to go back in time when the Greeks were really arguing about whether or not things are made of atoms and say, look, here's an atom, here's another atom, there they are, you can see them. So the type of engineering which is happening in the effort to build a quantum computer is quite fantastic, and I hope it will have other applications as well.
Besides cryptography.
Yes, and I don't want people to think that cryptography is the only reason why we're driven to build quantum computers. In material science nowadays, so people are trying to build nanotubes, for instance, trying to build new materials that are extremely strong. Well, these are made of atoms, and they're quantum things. And if you're trying to do a computer simulation of them, it's for the same reason that quantum computers are more powerful than the ones we have today. It's very hard to simulate a quantum system on the computers we have today. The types of information that you need to keep track of in a quantum system is much more than a standard computer can hold. That's partly why it's so much more powerful. And so one of the reasons we want quantum computers is to be able to simulate quantum systems and be better at building them, creating new materials.
What's an example of a quantum system that you'd simulate?
Well, you've heard of these nanotubes that are basically made from soot.
I've never heard of nanotubes.
You've never heard of nanotubes?
No.
Oh, nanotubes are wonderful. So these are little tubes made of carbon, and one possibility is to build incredibly fine wires, narrower and thinner than any that we can make today, that could carry information or store information. And they're also incredibly strong. So this could come in handy for building materials that can, well, for instance, maybe have you heard of the space elevator?
Sure.
Yes. Not Willy Wonka's.
No, what's the space elevator?
Well, you know, I know that we humans have a lot on our plates right now, but one thing it would be nice to build if we get around to it and if we're not too busy spending all our time and money on other things would be a space elevator. So this would be something where it's anchored somewhere on the equator, and it's a cable going all the way up and out into orbit. You want to get into orbit instead of having to sit on a huge rocket full of exploding fire. You would ride your way up there. And many people think that this is one of the few ways that space travel could actually become practical. The problem is that it would have to be built out of incredibly strong stuff.
Indeed.
But I'm told that these nanotubes are a possible candidate. They're sort of within shouting distance of the strength that we would need. But it's hard to make more than very small bits of it at once. And so... But the materials that people are trying to make today involve, they're pretty exotic. And in order to understand them, a quantum computer would be very helpful.
Just listening to you talk, it seems like it would be helpful for understanding the brain as well, if you're going to model a system like that.
There's a lot of controversy about whether or not quantum mechanics plays a role in the brain. And certainly, you know, when you read things in popular science books, there's a lot of discussion of the relationship between quantum mechanics and consciousness. And this is not something that people really understand, and consciousness, of course, is still a mystery. I'm not sure myself how much quantum mechanics has to do with the way that we think. The brain is kind of as people say, it's a hot and wet, very chaotic place. And quantum computers are, as far as we know, they're very delicate. On the other hand, there's been some interesting work lately showing that quantum mechanics plays a role in the way that plants photosynthesize, and maybe even in how birds navigate. They have microscopic little bits of magnetic material. And a friend of mine, Seth Lloyd, who's a very well-known quantum person who's spending this year at the Santa Fe Institute from MIT, was telling me that quantum mechanics seems to play a real role in these biological systems.
Well, if you build a quantum computer, you use it to model all kinds of things. I mean, cryptography is also not based on quantum mechanics.
Right. Right. So the purpose is to do all sorts of different kinds of computation in ways that are more powerful than the computers that we have today.
Right. I mean, you couldn't model, even if you could understand all the activities that were going on in 1 second in the human brain, we don't have the power to model them yet.
That's true. Yeah, we don't. I think the difficulty with understanding the brain is we don't, we have no idea what the internal language is that the brain uses to store ideas and information. We don't really understand how creativity works, how intuition works. So I don't know if the problem there is... I don't think the problem there is that our computers aren't big enough. I think our fundamental understanding of the brain is not there yet.
Right. It strikes me also, and maybe this is sort of a platitude, but when you talk about building a wire that goes all the way out to space or building quantum computers, these are tremendous feats, and yet we can't solve the most basic things like water use, war prevention,
global warming,
and food healthcare. Distribution.
Yes. Yeah. And I think...
Why don't you guys do that?
Well, I mean, as a citizen, I'm interested in a lot of things, and one of the wonderful things about the Santa Fe Institute is that we do research on a wide variety of things. There are people there who think about ecology and food webs and how food webs are robust or whether, in what ways they might collapse due to things like global warming. So we have a lot of people there who study social and technological networks, and who try to understand, how is it that information spreads through a social network, how opinions spread through a social network. So, yes, I mean, on the one hand, I would love to see quantum computers and space elevators. I would also love to see every child have enough to eat and be able to go to a decent school. So whether we're going to get around to these things, I don't know. But I hope that we have the... I hope that we have the political will to solve all problems and to move forward, but I guess that's an experiment that we'll see the results of this century.
Chris Moore is a professor of computer science, physics, and astronomy at the University of New Mexico, and he's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.